Welcome to the Anarchy Gumbo Podcast. Michael W. Dean of the Freedom Fiends cooks up a very special blend of liberty, guns, sex, rock and roll, drugs, and thriving in spite of the state in an increasingly worrying world. All with a rotating cast of nifty guests who are also up in the middle of the night.
So today on the Anarchy Gumbo Podcast, we are interviewing a mysterious creature, a mysterious man who cannot be named. Goes by the name of Plato. We'll just call him that, Plato. I think for a picture, I'm going to use one of those photo not available, like, you know, chat picture pictographs. What happened was I did this interview with this guy. Do you want to say hi, Cody? Cody, you there? Hello?
Cody, who's Cody?
I mean, Cody.
I'm not Cody.
No, I was thinking about my next thought. This is my fourth interview today. Sorry, Plato.
No problem. All right, so do I call you Michael? Do I call you Michael or Anarchy Gumbo?
I'm Michael. Right, Anarchy Gumbo is just my username on this particular encrypted Mumble chat. My Mumble server was down, was it?
I was not able to join it with the credentials you gave me.
Huh, that's weird. Okay. So I got a Google alert for Anarchy Gumbo, the podcast that this is going on. It's also on the Liberty Radio Network. It's broadcast on some actual radio. And it was for, I interviewed this guy named Cody, who's doing this printable gun project. And it was mentioned in an interview or a roundtable on agoristradio.com. And I went and listened to that. And it was five, I guess, agorist or anarchist computer security experts, I'll say, a better word than hacker for me, I think, because the connotations of hacker, guys who really knew their shit about computer security. And I learned a bunch of stuff from it, and I went and tried to contact y'all, and it's like, it was full of mystery and back, even contacting y'all, there's like no contact info. It's like, go into this secure chat and introduce yourself and have people you don't know be suspicious of you. And then you ask me a test question. It was kind of like, you know, All the President's Men, like meeting the cigarette smoking man in the shadows or something. So, but hey, I got a hold of you.
Like Smuggler says, privacy is not granted. It's something you take.
Well, I guess I took it. I guess I demanded enough and convinced y'all that I was not from the NSA. And, but, you know, basically my thing is, can I ask you a question? You can answer this yes or you don't have to answer this, but are you a gun guy?
I don't own any guns. I'm fascinated by them and, a little intimidated by them.
Okay. I'm a gun guy. I actually moved out of California and moved to Wyoming so I could legally carry a firearm. And when people want to get into guns, you know, basically like what I ask them is, are you going to be a gun person or do you just want something you can carry for day-to-day security that will require a little practice once in a while, but you don't have to become a gun person to use it? And for people that, you know, want to become gun people, I have about 80 different recommendations. But for people that just want to be a gun, you know, someone with a gun who's not going to be a target and can protect themselves, I usually recommend a revolver because it's the simplest, fail-safe. You know, it's for up close and personal. You don't have to be able to aim really well at a distance. They never break down. They usually only hold five or six shots, but that'll do it. That'll get you out of there. You know, so what I want to ask is a bunch of questions about computer security for me and a lot of our listeners. For me, I basically want to be with computer security the way someone carrying a revolver would be. Like, I don't have the time or the mind to become a security expert, but I want to know, like, you know, eight things I can do to help me not be watched by the man, kind of the revolver in the purse kind of version of security.
All right, fair enough. Well, let's start with the basics. So the traffic going through the internet is spied upon by a bunch of people. Notably, the NSA has these wiretap cabinets where at ISPs they just take the fiber line, put it through a beam splitter, and send the packets to the left to their destination and to the right into an NSA computer. And now they actually have the capability to save all of that and just rewind it and play back and look at all the emails that are sent ever. So when you're sending an email, it's being transmitted as plain text. And there's something called SSL. That's the little green lock that you see in your browser when you go to an HTTPS site. That's a slight improvement over regular HTTP because it means that the communications between your computer and the server are encrypted. But if that server is, say, Gmail, that isn't really going to help because Gmail will gladly hand over your entire account if the government comes a knocking.
So, yeah, and even if you are using an anonymous name on Gmail and routing through another IP address somewhere, they could probably figure out who you are based on how much Google tracks you when you're logged in all over the web. They'd be like, well, we know this guy's into guns. We know he likes things about Wyoming. We know he's into cats, et cetera. And they could narrow it down a lot, right?
Yeah, it's like a digital fingerprint. And the people you communicate with, that's another variable that I imagine would be useful for correlation. The time zones you log in from, the IPs you log in from. A good layer of security to start with is a VPN. That's a virtual private network.
Got one.
The idea is that you install it on your computer, and then you run the VPN, and it connects to a server in Uzbekistan or Liberia or anywhere. You can find VPNs all across the world. And all the traffic through your internet, I'm sorry, all of your internet traffic it goes through this tunnel, and it appears to be coming from the VPN server.
Do you recommend pay ones over the free ones?
I would recommend one that takes Bitcoin, and I would also recommend if you can connect to it with Tor.
One that takes Bitcoin, so they don't know who you are, right?
Yeah, most of them you can pay with PayPal, but that's really hardly better than, you know, plain text browsing, because PayPal has, you know, your real name, your credit card number, all the information that a state needs to find you. And if you're paying a VPN and giving them that information, well, they'll have that information too, and it's subpoenaable. With Bitcoins, at least they can't find you through the money. They might still be able to find you through, you know, behavior patterns, or if you connect directly to that VPN. The VPN does know your IP address. So that's why I'm saying if you route it through Tor first, then the VPN sees a Tor connection coming in.
Now, and that's
pretty strong.
Would your local ISP know that you're connecting regularly for hours at a time through a foreign IP address?
Probably. I don't see why not.
Would they would not be able to see your traffic, right?
That's correct. VPN traffic should be encrypted end-to-end.
But they would see, would they be able to see that you're using encrypted traffic?
Again, I guess so. I'm not an expert on it, but, I mean, they'll at least be able to look at it and see that, you know, there's gigabytes of traffic moving here through here, and none of it is obviously anything. So it's a good assumption that it's encrypted traffic.
Is using things like this and other things we're going to talk about bulletproof and airtight, or is it more like normal surfing naked is like leaving your front door unlocked, and using all this stuff is like having a good lock on your door and cameras and alarms, but someone could still get in if they were really motivated?
I'd say the latter. If you have like a state who's actually targeting you and trying to track you down and trying to catch you, they're probably going to be able to track you down and catch you because they have immense resources. And once you get to like the social engineering side of things, and you know, you find yourself talking to some girl at a bar who's been planted there by the CIA.
Some girl that's interested in all the things you're in and will fuck on the first date. That's possible. Are you there?
Yes, I am. Yep. I'm trying to think if I've ever met an anarchist girl. And I met a couple at Occupy camps.
I know, but
at Occupy San Francisco.
Wow, I know a lot of girls that are anarchists, but they're anarcho-capitalist, and the Occupy people tend to be anarcho-syndicalist. So maybe the anarcho-capitalist is where the chicks are. The anarcho-capitalism.
Perhaps. I'd identify myself as an anarcho-capitalist.
Free State New Hampshire has dozens or scores or hundreds of girls that are anarcho-capitalists or some variation on that. Free State New Hampshire. Free State Project New Hampshire.
I like Free State Project, and I would consider moving to New Hampshire.
Are you willing to say where you live, or is that personal, private?
For now, upstate New York.
I'm from upstate New York. I am from a little town called Westfield, and I went to college in Jamestown, and I used to summer in Chautauqua. Do you know where those places are?
Negative.
Far western county of New York, Chautauqua County. It's on Lake Erie. It's like 10 miles from Pennsylvania.
Oh, nice. So you get lake effect snow, and you get snowed in all winter.
Yeah. I moved to D.C. when I was 18, and then moved to San Francisco when I was 21, and then moved to L.A., when I was 30. I'm 48 now, and my wife and I have lived in Wyoming in the past 3 years, and we were like, you know, she'd never been in snow, and I grew up in it, and I was bracing for brutal winters here, but Casper, Wyoming is actually pretty mild compared to upstate New York where I grew up.
I drove through Wyoming during my Bitcoin road trip.
Ah, Bitcoin road trip. I'd love to hear more about that.
Okay, so April 2011... I hopped my car and I started driving west. I was living in Hartford at the time. So by July, I ended up in California. And the entire trip, I didn't touch any U.S. currency. I only spent bitcoins.
Wow. Did you make a video about this? It sounds familiar.
I took a bunch of videos along the way, and I lost about 90% of them due to two hard drives failing at once, which still upsets me.
Ah, well, you know, one of the things I always recommend, I've never been that much into security, but I'm trying to get into it now, which is why I'm talking to you. But I've always been into doing computer stuff, and like every book I've ever written and every recommendation I've ever given has been like, you know, rule one, back everything up in triplicate.
Yeah, should have used three instead of two.
Shoulda, coulda, woulda. Yep. So I haven't gotten into the Bitcoin thing yet. The Free State New Hampshire people who are big friends of mine, and they syndicate, you know, Free Talk Live Radio. Ian from that runs the Liberty Radio Network, which Anarchy Gumbo and my other podcast, Freedom Fiends, go on. They're huge proponents of that. I don't even have a Bitcoin chip in yet for my, you know, we take PayPal donations and are not doing the Bitcoin thing yet. We should be. What do you think about...
Wait, let me interrupt you, because in Hero and my episodes of Coinbase, most recent ones, 4 and 5, we explain these things called brain wallets. You can go to bitaddress.org or brainwallet.org, and you can think up a passphrase, just some sentence or something that you're going to remember that nobody else is ever going to guess. You type it in, and bam, it gives you a bunch of Bitcoin addresses. And as long as you remember that passphrase... then at any point from any computer, you can just go to that website, enter it, and get your Bitcoin address, and you'll have access to your funds. So you can do that and just get an address and put it on your website. That's all it takes.
Okay.
And then anybody else can copy and paste it and send Bitcoins to it.
Is that as secure as doing it the right way with the downloadable wallet and everything?
It's a trade-off because you don't have a wallet file to lose, but you do have a passphrase to lose. And if somebody does manage to guess it or brute force it or beat it out of you with a rubber hose, they can type that passphrase in and take all your coins.
Yeah. I mean, that kind of reminds me of Hushmail. Do you know much about Hushmail?
Oh, man. Yeah. I actually was talking to John Matanis on Twitter about an article he recently posted where he recommended Hushmail for anonymous email. And I disagreed with that because...
I disagree, too.
For anyone who doesn't know, Hushmail... offered some PGP email service. The idea was you would, you know, type in your passphrase, it would go to their server, they would encrypt and decrypt and send you back your files. And people didn't like that, so Hushmail provided this this downloadable Java app where it would locally do the signatures. But when the government asked them to, the government said, hey, we want some information on your users. And Hushmail takes their Java app and modifies it to sniff the passphrase and tell Hushmail what the user's password is, even though the user's typing it on his own computer. And they deliver this app, this malicious app, to the users who just run it and give away their passphrases and bam, jail.
Yeah. And they did that without a warrant too, right?
Not sure.
I believe. I wouldn't swear on it, but I believe they did.
This did happen after John Matonis' tenure working with that corporation, so it wasn't his fault.
Okay.
But he still did recommend it, and I gotta disagree because, I mean, they've already showed their true colors. They are not acting in the behalf, you know, in the best interests of their users.
Yeah, I mean, that's a trade-off with privacy versus ease of use, which is why I haven't gotten into it a lot. I mean, I had a PGP account and used it, and I had, like, first of all, I had to go onto a computer, boot it into Linux, and, you know, read it, and then it was usually someone asking me about the weather, which is fine. I mean, I think the more people that use encryption and privacy for, you know, non-mission critical stuff, the better for everybody. But, you know, the internet as designed with HTML, with typing something into a browser with TCP/IP, the basic idea of it is it's not secret and you're allowing anyone into a certain section of a computer. And that's the ease of use that makes it beautiful. What do you think about the amount of work it takes for the trade-off of having some security and privacy?
Honestly, I think that it's so hard to do it perfectly that it's not even really worth the effort. I would rather just not be involved in activities that are going to get me killed or go to jail and use what tradecraft I can on, you know, the less dangerous, less risky stuff, because it's just effectively impossible to really have true security with the setup we have now. We're not going to be able to, grandma's never going to be secure on the current internet. It's going to take the next generation systems, Reddit's Hyperborea, Meshnet, Trust Networks, open transactions for making contracts and trades. When that sort of system is implemented and used widely, that can be secure because we're designing that stuff from the ground up to make sure that, you know, some authority can't just take the info.
When you say we, are you including yourself? Are you working on that?
I would include the entire crypto anarchist community. There's, you know, millions of projects that are, well, let's say thousands of projects that are aimed at the idea of making it easier for a voluntarist state to exist.
See, my thing, my take on all that is what I do, what my partner does, what a lot of our listeners do too. We are not agorists. We are anarcho-capitalists, but we reluctantly obey all laws. All our guns are legal. We pay our taxes. We don't have any black market thing going on the side. I kind of believe in a way, I heard someone say that you can either be an agorist or an activist, but not both. And I know people who are agorists and are like, yeah, man, fuck the man. I'm not paying my taxes and, you know, I'll have whatever guns and weed I want. And it's like, I don't think that's something you can shout from the digital mountaintop. I think you have to pick one or the other.
No, it's not. It's definitely not. I mean, obviously be smart about it. Don't admit to crimes on the internet.
What I'm looking for is protection from the fact that everything I'm doing is legal and moral, and it may not be legal soon because of the way things are going. And also, a lot of state agencies, and I'm not just picking on the United States here, that's where I live, so it's the most obvious to me, but any state is going to try to harm people that disagree with it loudly. And I disagree with it loudly on a daily basis to as many people as possible. And they tend to do things like, you know, I mean, a perfect example, there was actually a case years ago where, like, the ATF was trying to set up somebody who was a legal machine gun seller. There are legal machine gun sales in this country. They're very expensive and they're very restricted, but there is a hobbyist community of them. And there was somebody who, you know, they didn't like the guy because he was selling a lot of them, and he was selling them to nonviolent, non-criminal people, but they didn't like it. So they were trying to bust him. So they went to a gun show and walked up to some guy on the line, random guy, and said, "Hey, where's Bill?" And they're like, "Oh, he's three guys down. He's right over there." And they went down and they set up Bill and they arrested him. And then they arrested the guy who said, "Oh, that's Bill over there," and charged him with conspiracy. I mean, that's the kind of shit they do.
Man, that's some thuggery right there.
Yeah, yeah, thuggery. That's a word.
Well, let me answer your question about, is agorism worth it? It's a cost-benefit analysis. If you're engaging in risky behavior, you have a cost, which is, you know, the risk of getting injured, harmed by the state. And you may have some benefits of maybe advancing liberty or getting rich or making people happy. And it's everybody's individual decision, you know, what actions you're going to take. And right now, the software that we have and the tools we have are not adequate to make that choice. I want to see it so everybody has the very obvious option. Oh, I can either use this Bitcoin system and just ignore the state and follow these like open source rule sets instead of the state's laws, and we'll work everything out without having to deal with the state, or I can, you know, go the state route. And I want it so easy and so effective and so good to go the agorist, anarcho-capitalist free culture route that there's no real reason for anybody to use the state except, you know, politicians and lawyers.
Yeah. And there's actually a few good lawyers out there. I argue a lot with people who want to represent themselves. I think that's fine for a traffic ticket, but it's probably not a good idea for people facing double felonies. And I know people who've done it and it hasn't gone well.
Yeah, it's scary because, I mean, in court, you know, like a basketball court is where you're playing basketball. Court is where you're playing the game of justice, and you're playing by their rules and you're playing with their ball. So, I mean, if I end up in court, I'll be wearing a suit. I'll most likely be respectful to the judge. I do want to look into some of the more wild theories I've heard on the internet about sovereignty and UCC1 forms and withdrawing your consent officially and telling the courts, you know what, I'm refusing to participate because I think your whole rules are bogus. And I have no idea how any of this stuff works, and I've never been able to find good information on it. If anybody like has, you know, I authorities have on this, if you can cite me the laws that says I can be a sovereign citizen, please contact me and let me know about that, because I've been looking for a while.
I know a lot about it. It won't work. You'll end up in prison.
I didn't think so.
There's it's morally correct, and it's probably legally correct, but it don't work. And there are people who say, well, I've tried it in court for this traffic ticket, and it's like, that's a traffic ticket. Call me when you're facing two felonies, you know, in Texas or something. It does not work. It's a fantasy. I almost think, and the people who are really into it are so religious about it, and religious is the word, that they do not accept any criticism or any argument, to the point where I almost think some of the people running it on, you know, the movers and shakers of it might even be false flag government employees.
Sure. It seems like a strong distraction, because I've met a couple of these guys, sovereign citizens, self-proclaimed myself. And yeah, they're like super, they're nutty about it. And
it's if voodoo,
they're nutty,
man,
about it because it's actually legit and like it's just suppressed knowledge, okay, that's good. If they're just nutty about it, then, you know, I don't want to waste my time with it.
Well, they name things as victories that aren't, you know. Another ant on the pile, just, you know, average Joe going into traffic court and saying, you know, what is your authority under which you represent me? And the judge, you know, traffic court judges deal with 100 people a day, and they basically want to get home to their wife and kids, and they're like, ugh, okay, and they throw it out. That happens once in a while. But, you know, people who think that they can send something to their government and post something in the newspaper that says, I renounce thee, I renounce thee, I renounce thee, in whatever UTC, you know, uniform code language they want to put. If they think that they can do that and then walk down the street in LA or New York City smoking a joint and carrying a sidearm, and when the police comes up, they show them this paper they printed out, and the cop's going to say, oh, I'm sorry, I do not have jurisdiction over you. They are fucking delusional.
Yeah, it's unfortunate. Do you think that would still be the case, though, if we had, let's say, I don't know, 10% of the country who, you know, were clued in on this and were willing to hang juries and nullify jury verdicts for, well, I mean, I guess it's a different problem.
Well,
that wouldn't be sovereign
citizen it's related.
Stuff. That would just be for the traffic tickets.
It's related. You're saying, you know, what percentage of people would have to withdraw consent before the state would say, I'm
DDoS,
sorry.
To DDoS the justice system, in
yeah,
fact.
Yeah. You know, what that question is basically saying, how many soldiers do you have to throw in front of the machine guns until the enemy runs out of bullets? You know, the answer is not infinite. It's a number, but I'm not going to do it.
All right.
You know, my tack is basically educating as many people as possible, and it may be magical thinking to think that if you educate enough young people and older people that the state has no consent, taxation and nanny laws are enforced at the barrel of a gun, and, you know, the answer to the fact that there are immoral people in the world is not to elect immoral people to, or even to elect moral people. You know, it's all, I just spent all my time trying to tell people the facts, and I hope that somehow that'll make a difference.
It is, and it will, because what you're describing is just, it's a mental shift. That's all it is. Like, if, you know, as we say, if one day X percent of the people wake up and decide we're all on the same page about these, you know, giant global political issues, and we want to just, you know, give some other systems a shot, that's all it would take. Like, just some critical mass.
Yeah, but I don't think the way to get there is to have everyone go into court representing themselves and ask the judge, under what authority do you feel you can give me a fair trial? Which, you know, I mean...
Yeah, I mean, well, it's not like the primary method, but if you're doing like 100 little subversive things, that's just one more, you know, thing you're throwing in the machine of American justice.
Yeah.
That machine, by the way, that machine is just... It started small in, like, you know, a couple centuries ago, and they've been just tacking shit on ever since. And right now it's shitting out money. Like, it takes the money and the sweat and toil of the American people. That's its input. And its output is supposed to be, you know, a society that functions and, you know, feeds hungry people and fights fires and shit. But all the money's just, like, falling out the bottom into the bucket that's owned by the banks. So it's a systemic issue.
Well, you're preaching to the choir here, and I mean, basically, I've put out over 200 episodes or 100 and some episodes of Freedom Fiends over the past year and a half, and a bunch of Anarchy Gumbo episodes where basically my co-host and I spend an hour and a half twice a week really intelligently extrapolating on what you just said. And I've gotten to the point where I'm sick of just talking about the tyranny today. And I, for one thing, I want to offer real solutions. And for another thing, I want to make media that will be listened to in 100 years. And a lot of podcasts about tyranny of the state are more like the daily newspaper, whereas okay, we want to do stuff that's more enough, like the book, you know? So one of the solutions,
let's stop talking the talk and walk the walk. So let's start with Mumble. Right now, you and I are talking on Mumble, which is an open source program that allows for encrypted voice communications. This is better than Skype because, as you would hear in Reality or Exploit Roundtable episode 5, Skype has been bought by Microsoft, and they're unwilling to release their source, and they're actually unwilling to even say, we can't listen to your calls. So it's very likely that
and
Skype
can
probably
your,
listen
can,
to your calls.
They can log your keys, too, right?
That's speculation on the part of our panelists. We're saying that Skype could be logging your keystrokes and reporting everything you say back, as could any X Windows or Microsoft Windows program.
You're listening to the Anarchy Gumbo Podcast, a tasty stew of freedom and fun. Subscribe at kittyfeet.com. That's KittyFeet.com.
So, Skype bad, Mumble good. Mumble's a little harder to use. Like, I actually have to pay like $3 a month for a Mumble server. Do you guys have a Mumble server?
Unofficially, just nothing public.
I mean, do you have a recommendation for a company that hosts those?
I'm sorry, I don't know.
Okay. The one I use is at mumble.com, and it's like $3.50 a month for up to 10 users. So Mumble's good.
Mumble's good. Before, you and I were talking about text communication. And for that, you got some options. Your standard Gmail chat is an implementation of a protocol called XMPP. I don't know what that stands for, but it's basically, you know, instant messaging. Google has a feature that they call OTR, and that stands for off the record. On Google, all that means is they claim not to say blogs. When most people say OTR chat, they mean a specific encryption plugin that encrypts traffic, text chats between Alice and Bob so that nobody in the mail can read them. And even actually, if somebody saves those messages and decrypts them in the future, they don't get access to the rest of Alice and Bob's messages. It changes the keys, I guess, per session.
Can you explain Alice and Bob for listeners who don't know cryptography?
Alice is user one, Bob is user two. It's just a convention to drop ABC names when you're using people as examples. Yeah. So Alice and Bob are just two people who want to talk privately without being overheard by Eve, an eavesdropper.
You jump straight to E for Eve?
Yeah, the eavesdropper is too good a alliteration to pass up. So anyway, you can use that OTR on XMPP. You can plug it into Pigeon if you use Pigeon for chat. I'm sure other chat suites have that as well. I think iChat does. You can also use it on IRC, Internet Relay Chat, and that's old school chat rooms.
I met you, I guess, on IRC through MIBIT. Is that what it's called?
Yeah, that's correct. You were connected to the anarplex.net server using the MIBIT web interface.
Now, is that secure, and is that something people need to pay for a server to use?
It's not. MIBIT is not secure because, first of all, you're talking to a website, MIBIT.com, and that website is operating on a server somewhere owned by, you know, MIBIT Incorporated, and whoever's running that server has access to everything you're doing, so they can see the stuff you're typing, they can see stuff people are typing to you, any private messages. I've never heard of using OTR in a web client. I would be cautious about it and understand how it worked first. So short answer, MIBIT would not give you security. You would want to get a IRC client that's running on your local machine. MIRC is traditionally the Windows client. I've heard that it's full of bugs and security holes, so you might want to Google and find something better if you're on Windows. I use IRC, IRSSI, on Linux, and I'm very happy with that. But most or all IRC software should be able to talk to each other with OTR plugins.
What do you think of crypto.cat?
It's an awesome example of what you can do with JavaScript, and I listened to a really good talk by the author of that where he was explaining how they built it and its weaknesses and its strengths. And Hiro and I talk about that on Coinbase 4 a bit, because the big thing is, can you trust the code that was served to you? You go to the website crypto.cat and your computer talks to another computer across the internet, and that computer replies and says, here's your web page. It contains this awesome program that lets you chat encryptedly. Is that computer telling the truth? You're not sure, because somebody along the way in the middle might be able to swap it for a malicious one, or the guy at the end might be malicious and just give you a bad package. So right now, that's the problem with CryptoCat. And it's not solved yet. There's some ideas. Again, check out Coinbase 4 for more.
I think there's another problem with it too. I was using it for a while, and I went and tried to use it yesterday, and now to use it, you have to use the Chrome browser, which isn't particularly problematic as far as I know, except I think, anyway, you have to be logged in now to use it, and that kind of defeats the purpose of anonymity.
That surprises me. I do remember the guy who made it, the creators, saying that they were going to move to a Chrome web app, because that lets you install the software. It's basically just making a copy of the CryptoCat web page and saving that on your local computer. And once you do that, then you don't have to worry about some man in the middle stealing it and swapping it for a bad thing, because you download it once from the author, and it's supposed to be more secure. I wouldn't trust it yet.
When I logged on to your Mumble channel, I got a warning that said the security certificate may have expired, and went ahead and accepted it anyways. Should I have done that, and what does that mean?
So that certificate is that's part of the public key of the server. Encryption uses a public key and a private key, and it's a cool process. You can look up the technical details. The gist of it is saying that you're connecting to an encrypted server, and this is the information that the server is providing about its encryption procedures. Do you want to trust it? In this case, it's just a server running on someone's computer, so they did all the crypto stuff themselves, and you can trust it because they made their own certificate. It's kind of the same idea for SSL in websites. If you see the green lock, then your web browser has recognized the certificate or the public key that the website you're trying to access told you.
Okay. What do you recommend for people for encrypted email that's easy to use and relatively secure?
I don't think there is such a thing. The best you can do is PGP, as far as I know.
So are you saying that there's nothing that's terribly secure and easy to use, or that's secure?
Both, because as we were talking about before, there's still all kinds of correlation attacks that you can make against encrypted email, and not to mention the easiest one of get physical access to the computer and install a keylogger and record their passphrase. So those are the attacks against encrypted email. It's unlikely that an encrypted email will be decrypted, because it still takes quite a lot of computing power. It's hard to tell how long that'll last, because, you know, the NSA's data center in Utah they're building, I'm pretty sure that that they're putting in 30,000 tons of cooling equipment for that's just the AC that they need for their miles and miles of underground racks of servers to store all the emails, so they can eventually go back and crack them if they need to. I was going to also say that you should be able to find mail programs like Thunderbird or I think Claws Mail that interface with PGP. So those will make it easier to use PGP to encrypt your emails. The thing is that the guy on the other end needs to have it installed too. And that's the real problem, because most of the time you're using email to communicate with someone who isn't particularly interested in using crypto.
Yeah. Yeah, we have a name for that that facility in Utah, the Freedom Fiends. We call it the Central Scrutinizer.
Nice.
Which is a reference to something on a Frank Zappa record from about 1,000 years ago. Were you ever a political person? Did you used to vote?
I had like super vague political beliefs throughout high school and college, for that matter. Just, you know, parroting whatever the people I trusted most said, and never really giving it too much chance. I'm never really giving it too much thought. That held true really until the middle of my Bitcoin road trip. I talked to Clint Richardson in Salt Lake City. Clint Richardson has a blog, realityblogger.wordpress.com, I believe, and he publishes some crazy, really interesting stuff. And he gave me a copy of Larkin Rose's book, The Most Dangerous Superstition.
I've interviewed him. He's great.
I met him at Libertopia in San Diego, and I got him to autograph my book. But that book goes, like, right from the beginning, it outlines, like, okay, you got to start thinking about this concept called authority and realize that all that means is that there's one group of people who get to rule other people, even though it's accepted that no one person can rule somebody else just on a personal level. And from there, he derives the whole, you know, concepts of anarchy, and it made perfect sense to me. So I said, okay, let me try this and see how that works.
Yeah.
And I found a bunch of good subreddits, /r/ cryptoanarchy, /r/agorism. And I've been evolving it ever since.
Yeah, Larkin is really good at explaining everything. I recommend him to a lot of people who talk to, you know, like people that I used to know a long time ago who are like, hey, what's this liberty thing you're into? He's one of the first people I send people to, because he does the real, like, I mean, for lack of a better term, like, you know, anarchism for dummies. And I mean that in a good way. Like, he does some video. Have you seen his video, The Tiny Dot?
Oh, yeah. That's a classic.
Yeah.
He sounds so frustrated. It sounds like he's saying this for the millionth time and is starting to wonder why no one's paying attention.
Well, I understand that. And I get sick of explaining to people who would take care of the roads, or why don't you move to Somalia if you want guns and no government? And it's like, you know, first of all, Somalia has about four or five different governments, and now it's got U.S. boots on the ground, so it totally is not a libertarian paradise. And secondly, shut up, statist. And thirdly, who would take care of the roads in a free market? The same people who do now, the ones that actually work instead of standing around, and they do a better job and do it cheaper. But I just like to send people to Larkin Rows. It saves a lot of typing.
Certainly does.
So I was going to ask what was your path to liberty, but I guess you just said. But if you want to extrapolate anymore, go ahead.
I don't know. I'll take the opportunity to continue and say I'm still evolving my political beliefs, especially about property rights. And I had this idea today. I posted on Reddit in Debate a Communist. The poster asked, his name was W.B. Hyatt, I think. He asked, in an ANCAP society, if you have a bunch of people homesteading land and free trade and people are, you know, generally respecting each other and interacting voluntarily, what happens when all the land's full? Won't you have people who are passing down their farms and inheritances towards their kids? And eventually, after enough time and enough conglomeration, you end up with, you know, the continent of Goldman Sachs, who lets people live there in exchange for signing a contract that says you have to pay this much in usage fees and, you know, do X, Y, and Z, which is a de facto state. So here's my idea. I say, like I said, I'm still evolving this. This is off the cuff. But it seems to me that land is a scarce good that everybody on Earth has to share. Like, we only have this planet for now, so we should probably figure out a way to use it that is, you know, just for as many people as possible. So why don't we do this? There's like 150 million square kilometers. Let's make 150 million Terra coins, and this will be a currency unit. You'll take the number of Terra coins and divide it by the number of people on the Earth, and then you give everybody that fraction. So everybody starts with the same amount of this currency, and it's like representing their share of the land. So now you have an auction, and you spend these Terra bucks on different patches of land. And here's the kicker. You do this again every year. You're only purchasing like a 1-year lease on the land, and every year everybody gets their Terra bucks, they trade them around, and the developer who wants to build something, you know, he finds his investors who get the Terra bucks, who give them to him, he bids on the auction, gets the land for a year. And it seems like it might be a market-oriented way to deal with the problem of how do you distribute land.
Well, I'd also say that governments, including the United States federal government, own, for lack of a better term, they say they own huge, huge tracts of land that are unused. I mean, Wyoming is owned 49 or 51% by the federal government. I mean, there is room. There are resources. And I would also say, without the government, we'd be living on the sea, at the bottom of the sea, in space, floating 100 yards above Earth. I don't think land would be a problem. And I also think that, you know, the state is pretty much wrapped into the church. And without the church telling people, you know, there could still be a church, but if they'd stopped demanding that the government reinforce telling everybody that they can't use birth control or have abortions, I think there'd be a lot less problem with resource allocation. But that's really getting
pause. I'm going to forget what you're saying. Let me take two things. First off, is the land really owned by the federal government, not the state of Wyoming?
Both.
That's weird. It should only be the state of Wyoming. The federal government has its fingers in too many pies.
Something about a lot of the western states, like 49 or 51%, I can't remember, of Wyoming is owned by the federal government. And then like, you know, 10 or 20% more of it's owned by the state government. I would agree with what you say. But I'm not a state's rights guy anymore. I used to be, but it's like, okay, do you want to be tyrannized by the guy down the street or by the guy across the country, you know?
I'm thinking more as like a intermediate step towards eventual actual voluntary society.
Yeah.
It might be nice to have, you know, 50 competing states instead of one.
Yeah. I mean, that was the original idea of the Constitution, and I used to be a constitutionalist too until I really examined it and realized that the Constitution was set up to allow the government to expand. I mean, everything that people yell about being unconstitutional, a lot of it is constitutional, unfortunately. Obamacare is probably constitutional. I like the Bill of Rights as documents go, and I like the Declaration of Independence. Declaration of Independence is a fuck you to King George and to authority. The Bill of Rights is supposed to limit the authority of the federal government, but, you know, neither of them do, and we're on a slide to tyranny. That's a question I have for you, rather than playing Reddit games of this or that. And I would encourage you to get off Reddit and get onto the Daily ANCAP. I just sent you an email to it. It's basically a really good repository that updates with the RSS feeds of about 20 really amazing anarcho-capitalist resources, audio and video, including all three of my podcasts. And it's the real heavy hitters of the stuff, and you should check it out.
Oh, thanks for the link.
Reddit, you're just arguing with kids that live in their mother's basement who are parroting what you've been told.
You're on the wrong subreddits, man. The ones I read, there's a lot of good discussion, especially anarcho-capitalism and debate a communist.
Yeah, anarcho-capitalism threw my friend Ben Stone, the bad Quaker, off for calling someone thugs or something like that. It was ridiculous.
That surprised me. I would expect that from anarchism. But anyway, let me back up just one quick thing. You were mentioning like legislating morality and religion, and I was talking to my mom about like gay rights, and you know, my position is that the state is not a state's business. It's not a state's business. Who cares? Why are there any laws regulating this at all? And she's you know, a devout Catholic, and from her point of view, she's just upset about the terminology. She doesn't want gay people to say we are married. She's fine with saying that, you know, a gay couple has exactly the same rights as a straight couple, but just from her Catholic viewpoint, that word marriage is the only thing that's in the way. So it's just painful to see, you know, millions of dollars being spent and a lot of vehemence and a lot of misunderstandings about basically a terminological conflict. It's wasted effort and wasted energy.
Well, yeah, and like I said, I've done, you know, 90 minutes a week, twice a week for a year and a half debating this kind of stuff. And it's all, you're right, but I can have anybody on and talk about this. I got you on because I really want to talk about security. And it's all related, and I'm not, you know, damning you for bringing it up. And I think I brought us up and took us down the wrong road anyway. But do you want to talk more about security?
Yeah, got anything in particular in mind?
Yeah, I noticed something on y'all's site about something called Namecoin. Can you tell me about Namecoin?
Yeah, Namecoin is an early fork of the Bitcoin code base. And it's a distributed network, just like Bitcoin. You have a bunch of clients who are all talking to each other, and they have a blockchain that is keeping track of a bunch of data. That data includes who owns Namecoins, and it also includes some additional data. You can think of it as the Namecoin blockchain holding like a key value dictionary if you're a coder. It basically is a distributed database where you can store arbitrary information in this Namecoin blockchain. So if you put DNS information in there, say you have a site, agorastradio.com and agorastradio.bit, and maybe there's a .onion in there too. So you can use the Namecoin system to set it up so you go to agorastradio.bit, you type that into your browser, and it sends you to the .onion site, which is nice because you can't remember the names of .onion sites because they're just, you know, a bunch of letters and numbers. I'll come back to onions because I haven't explained Tor, which is a very important security tool.
Go ahead.
But the gist of it is, like, you can now remember just agorastradio.bit, which is a real name. That's the advantage of the DNS system. Instead of having to type, 98.76.54.32 to get to CNN.com, you type CNN.com and your computer does a lookup in the background to save you that step.
You're listening to the Anarchy Gumbo Podcast. That proves you're smarter than most people.
So does the Namecoin system allow people to have an address that would get people to their website if, for instance, some government entity took them out of the DNS records to block them, censor them?
Yes.
Is that the point of it?
That's a useful feature of it. You could point the .bit address at a regular IP or at a .onion address. So you could have your website running within the Tor network and totally unknown to the whole IP system, and you would still be able to access it by typing in the .bit address.
Is that the main point of its existence?
Yeah, it was founded to be a distributed DNS system. but it looks like with this key value functionality, you might be able to do more, like storing people's public keys in there. So you could go to plato.bit and you would be able to get my public key and my email and my Bitcoin address and personal information. So it's expandable.
Cool. How does that work and how hard is that to set up? And do people need, can they use a regular browser or do they need something else to use it?
Easiest way is a toolbar that Hero White built for Firefox. I'm trying to remember the name of it, but you can find it at Hero's Git repo, which is github.com/agorist radio.
Okay. Now, are you a fan of Tor?
I do like Tor. For anybody who doesn't know what Tor is, it's a piece of software that is it's a peer-to-peer network, and it's designed to route traffic between the users in an anonymous fashion. So once you connect to the Tor network, the communications that your computer is sending when it talks to other computers, they're all going through the Tor network and bouncing around to different peers and eventually getting out onto the main internet and talking to the destination. And same thing when it comes back.
I have a bunch of problems with Tor. I've played with it a bit. One is that it's really slow. The other is that anybody can set up a node, so they could set up a honeypot node. And I think my main problem with it is that it's not only was started by the U.S. government, but is maintained financially by the U.S. State Department. So basically, we're talking about an anonymity network that is under the auspices of Hillary Clinton.
Yeah, well, security experts tell me it's pretty good. I've also heard people talking about potential holes that are maybe enough to, you know, demask you. I wouldn't trust it with my life, but I might trust it to, you know, shuffle some Bitcoins around. And as far as being maintained by the government, I imagine they find it very useful to be able to evade other governments' cybersecurity systems. So from their point of view, I guess they're just doing a cost-benefit equation and saying, we're getting this much out of it, and it's hurting us this much from these activists. We'll keep it running.
Well, I mean, the history of it is it was invented by the by the U.S. government, U.S. Naval Research Laboratory, to allow countries that United States was trying to help reach democracy, which basically means install a puppet, you know, like Iran, Northern Korea, China, to have internet when internet is censored. I find it highly ironic that they're doing that for other countries while reducing our internet freedom here, too.
Yeah, it's doublespeak. I mean, look at Hillary Clinton talking about the war on drugs for more of that.
Yeah. They're not winning. I've noticed that. Do you think that when you're an old man, the geographic location known as the United States will have more freedom or less freedom than it has now?
I refuse to speculate on even if I'll ever even be an old man.
Okay. Why is that?
I don't know. Who knows? We could see nuclear wars. We could see somebody dropping vials of plague to try and wipe out most of the civilization and make everything else easier to control. Who knows? I hope that doesn't happen. I certainly hope that I live to a ripe old age and put my brain in a computer and everybody's happy.
Live forever in the network.
Let me go to a couple other darknets. Tor is an example of one darknet.
Define darknet. A lot of our listeners know nothing about what we're talking about.
Darknet is a network of computers that talk to each other that is apart from the main internet.
Okay.
So Tor is a darknet because these .onion sites are servers that are running that are connected to Tor but are not connected to the internet. That means that if you're sitting at your own desktop right now and you don't have Tor installed and you type in Silk Road VB5PIZ3R.onion, you're not going to get anything because your computer has no idea what that is. If you're connected to Tor and that's an actual onion address, then your Tor software will notice it and communicate with other Tor computers and find out what's at that address, and it'll return the Silk Road website for you to browse.
So well, I would say that our mumble conversation here is a dark net because there are more than two people on it connecting directly to each other without going through the, well, I guess you'd say that's going through the internet. It's not going through the web, right?
Right. It is going through, you know, actual ISPs somewhere, and it's standard HTTP packets, probably. I don't know how it actually communicates.
Okay. Darknet is peer-to-peer.
I guess with Tor, the actual traffic is still going over the ISP's wires. It's just encrypted. Because, okay. I mean, that's still how Tor computers have to talk to each other, because right now that's the only system that we got for actual, you know, moving electrical bits.
Mumble is encrypted.
From 1 to 0.
Isn't Mumble encrypted?
Mumble is encrypted, and that means that the ISPs where our traffic, the ISPs that are carrying our traffic cannot read our traffic. They can't hear our conversation.
But it's not tunneled, right?
No, it's just going across the same wires that AIM uses.
Can you explain tunneled?
Tunneled is basically just saying you're taking all the traffic that's coming from one source and moving it to another source. So you could set up multiple VPNs. You could have a server in Chicago that is listening on one port and sending traffic to another port, and you're tunneling. If there's a more technical definition, I don't know it, and I apologize.
Okay. So you had some other dark nets to discuss for security?
Freenet is one, and it's slightly different design. There's an Egress radio episode with DA2CE7 covering Bitcoin over Freenet, and it turns out the Bitcoin protocol would actually still work in an event the internet was wiped out. Say there's, let's say there's a kill switch flipped and none of the ISPs transmit traffic. It would be a hassle and it probably wouldn't work too well, but you can put Bitcoin transactions on a thumb drive and carry them to your friend's house, and he puts that information into Freenet. And if and when he gets some intermittent connection, then other Freenet users can pull out that information, reconstruct it, see there was an update to Bitcoin. But anyway, yeah, check out that episode if you want more. So that's Freenet. And another is I2P. I don't know a lot about it. It's Smuggler says it's better in many ways than Tor, so I should probably check it out a bit more.
Do you know about FidoNet?
Never heard of it.
It was an old BBS system that's still used over the internet for some things. I knew the guy who invented it, Tom. It was a really early way of sending emails when people actually had to pay long distance fees to go through BBSs to send them. That might be something to look at. I don't know much about it, but I kind of like the idea of maybe somebody finding a really old technology and repurposing it for the faster, better net and seeing if there could be.
Oh, dude, I think we could repurpose Usenet to great effect simply by signing the messages that are posted with our, you know, PGP keys, and then using some automation to keep track of reputation associated with each key. Because as long as you're signing each post with your key, then you can verify that it was actually posted by that. It opens up some neat doors. So I totally agree. And I think that, there's not really that far to go until we do have a system that works and is better than the state options.
Well, you know, everybody in school is taught that the U.S. Army invented the internet, and that's not actually true. A lot of private industry and persons had more to do with it. Douglas Engelbart, have you ever seen his Mother of All Demos video from 1969?
I'm not sure. Do you mean like a 3D technical demo of like graphics card?
No, not demo scene. Like, I'm talking about demonstration. It's called the Mother of All Demos. It's him at some university giving a speech to about 40 people, and they filmed it, and there's a YouTube video of it. It's about 9 segments of about 10 minutes each. And 1969, I mean, he's the guy who invented the computer mouse, Douglas Engelbart, and he demonstrates, you know, networking, the mouse, the graphical user interface, you know, collaboration by video over a network with somebody at a remote location. It's pretty, you know, tree-based file structures.
Was this the first time that the audience was seeing these concepts?
Yes.
That was remarkable. I'll have to look it up.
It's called The Mother of All Demos. Search that on YouTube, and it's like a 9-part series. It's black and white, 16mm film, and it's pretty damn amazing, man. You know, the TCP/IP wasn't invented by the government. It was invented by, God, I can't remember the guy's name right now. Do you know it offhand?
Nope.
He's a big wig at Google now, I think. Anyway, you know, it's what I'm saying is it's specious to say the government invented the internet. That's what a lot of people say, and they did not. Didn't single-handedly, for sure. And also, you know, it's like governments have monopolies on that kind of thing. In 1969, you know, a least dedicated phone line was like $30 a minute in 1969 dollars, you know, which is like $400 a minute now or an hour now. So it wasn't something that could be done easily without stealing a lot of money, unless it was done by private industry, which I think it would have been done without the government. So I don't think the government invented the internet.
Well, that monopoly carries me on to the most interesting meshnet, which is Reddit's darknet plan effort. This is based around something called CJDNS, and CJDNS is a whole... it's like the software side of the internet, except better. It's more than just a DNS system, and the idea is to build a whole network where all the nodes are talking to each other in a peer-to-peer mesh, and everything's encrypted by default. You don't have to know, you know, anything more than the route to get to your peer. And this is technically different than Tor, and it assumes from the beginning that you're going to have people with microwave dishes on top of their trailers pointing it at the mountain a mile away to, you know, hook up with the next town. So that's what this is aiming for, and this will not be controllable by a state because it's entirely peer-to-peer. You would just flash new firmware onto your Linksys router, and bam, now it's a mesh node, and it's talking to your neighbor's phone because he's participating too. And I mean, this is going to end with like New York City Times Square. You're going to have 5,000 people all with a cell phone, and all the cell phones are talking to each other, and you know they're sharing some data. And it's like, you know, the people's ground up horizontal spreading internet instead of this like vertical top down system where the guys at the top have all the power, and you know, not to mention the mandate of the government.
Do you know about internet in a box or internet in a suitcase?
Nope.
Internet in a suitcase. It's something that the U.S. government developed to use in you know, countries where they're trying to bring the boot of democracy, when the tyrants there shut down the internet and there are, you know, people in the street protesting the current tyrant that the U.S. wants to topple. It's basically a big suitcase that has the equipment that it needs to bring the internet to a neighborhood. It's, you know, a satellite transceiver, a generator, batteries, and you know, a Wi-Fi, a really, really strong Wi-Fi transmitter. I mean, they're not going to be downloading, you know, high-def movies on it, but it allows people to be able to tweet to each other and talk to each other over an area of like 5 square miles.
I have not looked into those, but here's the thing. You need the satellite link. You need the satellite link to talk to the rest of the internet.
Right, right.
With the mesh system, you don't put a satellite dish on it. You drop the package into your third world village, and it comes with a Wi-Fi router, you know, let's say 10 Wi-Fi routers and 50 smartphones, and you have a local mesh. It's
yeah,
not going to be
like,
talking to everybody else yet,
right.
But for now, you can at least have all these like sweet apps to help your community run better on its own local level.
Right. It's like the internet with radio waves. I believe that that's how those one laptop per child laptops work.
I wouldn't be surprised.
They do. In a neighborhood, only one computer needs to be in line of sight of, you know, something hooked to the internet. Are you there?
Yes, I am.
All right. Vincent Cerf is the name of the guy that invented TCP/IP, and he was, for a while, the chief internet evangelist at Google, and that's, you know, a position they made up for him. But he kind of looks like Ben Bernanke. He's an old dude.
Fair enough.
Yep.
Hey, you know why I am so confident in this MeshNet system and so excited?
Why is that?
Because you can base it off people's greed.
Greed.
You can set, yeah, you can set this up. You can set up your system so that you're charging a usage fee for the use of your device. If you're relaying traffic for your neighbors, you can put a price on that and say, you know, X credits per kilobyte. And this open transaction software that Fellow Traveler is doing, that's the software layer for contracts and money and that sort of stuff. So that's that part's done. It can be very trivial to have a currency that your router is automatically exchanging in and out as it's moving traffic. And now you have a free market on information. You can tell, you can say, like, I don't know, I'll carry this kind of traffic or that kind of traffic. Maybe not, because you might not be able to tell what's in the packets. But either way, you can get rich by offering a reliable node that has high traffic.
Sounds good. Do you think that using bitcoins gets you on a watch list, even if you're using them for legal purposes?
I've never thought about it. And
that's one of the reasons I'm not using them. I mean, because combined with everything else that I do that's legal, that the government hates, you know, being an evangelist for guns and freedom and bashing the state 24/7 on the internet, you know, it's like, do I really want to add, what's the benefit for me of adding one more layer of, hey, look at me, you should check me out?
The benefit is that it's a global currency system that's simple and can't be interfered with, or, well, at least hasn't been interfered with yet by states.
It's really taken off. And isn't there a limited amount of currency in the system? And if there needed to be more, couldn't someone make, you know, like Bitcoin or something similar with a similar algorithm with a different something?
Yeah, there have actually been, in addition to Namecoin, there were two more forks, Solidcoin and Litecoin, that offered slightly different systems. They're not Bitcoin. They're similar ideas. They have different ideas for how to distribute the money base and how to keep coins flowing. I think that Solidcoin has failed and Litecoin is, like, at least still around, but I haven't looked into them for a year.
Can you use the Namecoin system without buying Bitcoins or using Bitcoins?
I don't know if you can buy Namecoins on an exchange for dollars, but I bet that you can find somebody who will give you a few for free if you
evangelize them. I will evangelize them. If you can find someone that will give me two or three for, I mean, really one, you know, one or two for my main two domains, I will evangelize the hell out of them. What do you think about the secret identity of whoever came up with Bitcoin? I've heard a lot of different ideas, everything from, you know, some dude to some government to someone at Google. What are your theories?
We'll know when the first few coins are spent from the first blocks that were generated.
Because they're worth the most?
Well, no, just because they haven't been spent yet, and they were probably generated by Satoshi. So I'm sure people have some flags running, some, you know, just searches to keep an eye on blockchain.info for the first ever blocks to see if those coins move. And if they do, then maybe they can try and trace them and see where they came from. I have no speculation on who Satoshi is. I applaud his work and thank you.
Well, it would kind of it would go ahead.
Let me answer a previous question, which was the limited pool of Bitcoins. And that's correct. There's a maximum number of 21 million Bitcoins that will ever be created. Right now, we are, I want to say, about halfway there. I think 9 million or so have been dispersed. And they're distributed initially through mining rewards, which is the gist of it is that people earn Bitcoins by processing transactions for the network. And that's going to keep going for about 50 years, but it has diminishing returns, because as you approach 21 million Bitcoins, the miners start charging fees in order to use the network. And that's planned. But when you think about it, it means that there's only like so big of a Bitcoin pie. And right now, almost half that pie has been distributed to, you know, whoever owns all the Bitcoins now. And your stake in that pie is going to be the same slice today as it is in 50 years. But if the whole world's using Bitcoins in 50 years, they're necessarily going to be worth more because there's more stuff you can do with them.
It's kind of like buying stock at the beginning of a company that does well.
Yeah, it's...
Is there a way
to do it? It's as simple as you're holding on to a piece of this thing called Bitcoin.
Is there a way to do the equivalent of a stock split where you would take the existing coins and double the amount and make them each worth what they were before the split? And would there be an advantage to that for anybody?
No, you can't modify the number of Bitcoins, but you can send fractional Bitcoins down to 8 decimal places. So there's something like 4 quadrillion units of account. So, I mean, today a cheeseburger costs, half a Bitcoin. A year ago, it would, you know, some guys bought a couple pizzas for 10,000 Bitcoins. That was one of the first real-life Bitcoin transactions. Now 10,000 Bitcoins would be worth $100,000. So that guy, you know, profited well. And if you do the math, there's 7 billion people on Earth, 21 million Bitcoins total. That's one Bitcoin per 300 people. So if 1% of the world starts using Bitcoin, that's still one Bitcoin to be split for every 3 people. So it's a smaller pie than people imagine. And I mean, it's still not too late to buy some Bitcoins and get your slice.
Cool. I think we're about at the end of the time here. Do you have any closing statements? And I would like to have you back at some point in a few months, and I'd like to have your buddies back, and I'll go talk to them now. But do you have any closing arguments, closing statements?
Thank you so much for having me on. I have honestly never heard of your podcast before today, which I apologize for, and I will look it up because if you got a couple hundred episodes, I want to see what else you got.
Well, that's a big problem with Reddit is, you know, the anarchists on Reddit don't know who we are, and we have about 5,000 listeners. So
statistically saying, there's got to be like hundreds more communities like you out there somewhere, and they're just not all hooked together yet. So yeah. hopefully the mesh can take us there.
Yep. And, you know, that's something I like to do is hook up some people with other people. And I was really happy to discover an anarcho-capitalist computer security forum, because generally people that are into a computer security or hacker mentality are either working for the state or they are, you know, leftists who are trying to bring down the government so they can replace it with a communist government, I found.
No comment other than screw government.
Yep. All right, man. Thanks for staying on. Let's stay and chat a little bit after we stop recording here.
All right. Sounds good. I'm Plato. You can reach me on Twitter or Reddit or GitHub. My username is TheRealPlato on all three of those.
Cool. And do you have a website?
Nope. Not right now.
Of course you don't. I know. It's hard to find you guys. All right. Thanks, man.
Certainly. Thanks again for having me on. Cheers.
Worms.
This year, you can experience a taste of Libertopia. Libertopia is a voluntary community based on freedom and peace. Visit the 3-day festival this October 11th to 14th at Humphrey's Half Moon Inn on the San Diego Bay. With speakers, workshops, parties, and wonderful people, Libertopia has it all. Become a member of this peaceful voluntary community now. Visit libertopia.org. Tickets and hotel rooms are going quickly, so make sure to reserve yours today. Find out more at libertopia.org.
Since time began, tyrants have taken aim at personal liberties. Now there's a movie that aims back.
The government has no more right to tell us what to put in our bodies than they have to take our guns or tell us what books we can read.
6 drug police were eaten by bears while raiding a marijuana farm.
On your knees, you dirty hippies!
Jesus.
On your knees!
What's the problem, officer?
Today, many cops who enforce pot laws do so only because it provides them with cushy jobs, good benefits, and a chance to push people around.
I was an undercover narcotics officer. The drug war is nothing but a farce.
The Second Amendment says you gotta keep you and your gat intact.
Guns and Weed, The Road to Freedom. A film by Michael W. Dean and Nima Vadavi.
DVD available now at gunsandweed.com or on Amazon. That's gunsandweed.com. Makes the perfect gift. Remember, that's gunsandweed.com.
Thank you for listening to the Anarchy Gumbo Podcast. subscribe at kittyfeet.com. That's KittyFeet.com. All with a rotating guest on a spit, barbecued for your pleasure.
Outtakes, yay.